All right, everybody, it's 1 p.m. and as our attendees come into the room, I'm gonna get started with today's webinar with some housekeeping rules and logistics. So today's training is being recorded and will be offered on demand for those not able to join us live. The Kluent training page that brought you here offers the slides available for download under Download Training Materials. Please use the Q&A box to ask questions, make comments, or report any technical difficulties that you encounter. We will have two question and answer breaks during today's training, the first about halfway through, with the second at the end of the modules today. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they will be available upon the completion of the feedback form. Once you complete the form and click the box to certify that you participated, a certificate will be emailed to you. The feedback form is also available on the Kluent training page that brought you here today. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as Kluent. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of members from state agencies, the federal government, private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams, which produce tools and resources and training courses, such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be a member of ITRC, we encourage you to visit our website. On our website, you can register for teams and learn more about how you can become an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on our website as well. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. Now I'm going to turn it over to Valerie Hanley from the California Department of Toxic Substance Control to get us started on the microplastics webinar here today. Valerie, take it away.
Thanks so much, Devin, and welcome everyone to today's training on our ITRC technical guidance document on microplastics. My name is Dr. Valerie Hanley. I'm a senior toxicologist with the California Department of Toxic Substances Control, and I've been the co-lead on this team since its inception in 2021. And we're really excited to bring this training to you today. Let's see, go to the next slide. We've got some really excellent trainers today joining us, and they will all be introduced as we go along, but you can read all of their training bios on Kluent at the link that's down there at the bottom corner. And so we encourage you to do that. We will be showing this training roadmap throughout the day to help guide you in where we are in the training and to let you know what is coming up next. We're starting with an introduction. We're going to go through, we'll have an interactive case study that is going to be peppered throughout. In that case study, we are going to ask you to use the chat function to interact and answer the questions that are asked. That is separate than the Q&A pod, which is what we ask you to use during the Q&A sessions. And if you want your questions asked by the trainers in either of our two Q&A sessions, or sometimes we will answer those behind the scenes as well. So again, chat function for replying to the interactive case study, and then the Q&A function for asking questions. And with that, I'm gonna go ahead and hand it over to Dichle Yarnmichi from the California Department of Toxic Substances Control, and she's going to give us an introduction to microplastics. Dichle.
Thank you, Valerie. I'm just waiting to take over control. Thanks, Devin. Hello, everybody. I'm Dichle Yarnmichi. I'm with today. I will go over with you the introduction section of our training. And for ITRC's microplastics guidance document, and in this training, our overarching goal is to provide you guidance to understand microplastics and also the state of applied science without having to go to the scientific literature. And in this training, as Valerie mentioned, we will cover introduction to microplastics and their sources. I will go over that with you today, and then I will turn it over to our next speakers to talk about environmental distribution, fate, and transport of microplastics, sampling and analysis techniques of microplastics from various environmental media, Then we will talk about human health and ecological effects of microplastics. And we also compiled all the existing regulations from state, federal, and international level, all the way up to when we published our guidance document earlier this year. And then we will also talk about mitigation and abatement of microplastics. And with that, I would like to start with the history of plastic production. First, synthetic plastic was invented in early 1900s. And from 1930s to 45, there was an innovation of variety of plastics. But the biggest growth in plastic industry occurred in 1950s, and which also made the plastic to accumulate as plastic waste in the environment. As you can see on the plot on the left-hand side, there's a big uptick in the plastic waste as well, starting from 1950s. As we continue to do the business as usual, this plastic waste is expected to increase in the environment. And from 1970s and beyond, there was an innovation of bio-based and biodegradable plastics to tackle this plastic waste, plastic pollution. However, those weren't very great inventions in terms of the reducing plastic production, as biodegradable plastics often need certain conditions to be degradable, and as well as bio-based plastics are made from biosources doesn't necessarily mean that they're not going to accumulate in the environment. And as we talked about, once the plastic is made, it starts to accumulate as plastic waste in the environment. And this data here belongs to 2010. It shows that in that time frame, when there was 270 million tons of plastic was produced globally, at the same time frame, there was 275 million tons of plastic waste. Notice the plastic waste is higher than the global plastic production. That's because, as we mentioned, once the plastic is made, it starts to accumulate as waste from previous years in the environment. And over 99 million tons of that plastic is coming from coastal areas as plastic waste. Over 31 million of that is mismanaged, and which can end up putting 8 million tons of plastic waste per year to the oceans, and ten and hundred thousand tons of that plastic can end up in surface waters. And when we come to 2020, the global plastic production almost doubled in size, with approximately 500 million tons of plastic being produced globally every year. And that number is expected to increase if we continue with this plastic production, which will also eventually increase the plastic waste in the environment. And one of the, and today's topic is microplastics. And one of the sources of microplastics is this plastic waste is degrading in the environment over time, and that will create microplastics. And before we dive in, I would like to highlight why do we care about microplastics. So microplastics are found in various environmental media, including surface waters, drinking water, the air we breathe, and even the food that humans consume. They can accumulate and persist long time in the environment. They can also move long distances in the environment. And some of these microplastics can contain harmful plastic additives and chemical contaminants that will also, they will carry those chemical contaminants with them as they move throughout the environment. And microplastics are small. Because of their small size, they can be consumed by humans and other organisms, and they can cause adverse health impacts to the humans and organisms that are exposed to microplastics, which we will talk about in more detail later in this in today's presentation. And in our guidance documents, first of all, there is no universally accepted definition of microplastics, but microplastics are generally defined as plastic particles that are less than 5 millimeter in size. But there is no universally accepted definition. Therefore, ITRC's microplastics team reviewed all the existing definitions, and this is how we defined microplastics in our guidance document. Microplastics are solid polymeric particles that are greater than 1 nanometer and less than 5 millimeter in size in their longest dimension, to which chemical additives or other substances may have been added. And this definition doesn't include polymers that are derived in nature that have not been chemically modified other than hydrolysis. And just as a context, polymers are made of building blocks called monomers, and hydrolysis is a reaction that breaks down polymers into their monomers by using water. And we defined microplastic size ranging from larger than 1 nanometer and less than 5 millimeters. So this is a figure that is available in the chapter one of our guidance document to give you context about the size range of microplastics. Largest microplastics is smaller than 5 millimeters, and 5 millimeters is about the size of a drinking straw. And the smallest microplastics is larger than 1 nanometer, and which is smaller than a strand of a DNA. And in addition to size, microplastics have a variety of physical chemical properties. They can be made up from different polymers. They can also have different additives, such as plasticizers, flame retardants, colorants. And depending on the product type, they can also come from different sources, such as primary versus secondary microplastics, which we will talk about that in detail later in the presentation. And they can also come in different shapes, different colors. And some organisms, depending on the size, shape, and color, may confuse microplastics with food and feed on them. Microplastics can also absorb ecotoxins, such as PCBs, heavy metals, and others. As we mentioned, microplastics can come from different sources depending on product type, and generally they are categorized under primary versus secondary microplastics. This is a figure you can find this in chapter two of the guidance document. It shows you different product types as sources of microplastics. And primary microplastics are the ones that are intentionally manufactured as microplastics for specific products or applications. Some of the examples of primary microplastics include microbeads in personal care products, pre-production pellets, also known as nurdles. Nurdles are building blocks of manufacturing variety of plastic products. And as you notice in this training and also in our guidance documents, we use terms, and these terms are defined in the glossary section of our guidance document, which can be found in the appendix. I would like to highlight a case study. This is an example of primary microplastics nurdles that are being picked up by citizens and along the Gulf Coast of Mexico. And it highlights the importance of citizen science that can drive litigation and ultimately impact policy. And details of this case study can also be found in the appendix section of our guidance document. And secondary microplastics are the ones that originate from larger plastics that fragment into smaller pieces because they're exposed to environmental conditions such as UV light, wind, or water erosion. And some examples of the secondary microplastics include wear and tear of car tires, fragmentation of consumer products such as plastic water bottles, cigarette butts, and also the fibers that are shedding from synthetic textiles as microfibers because of being worn or washed over time. This is another case study that shows the example of secondary microplastics. It shows the disposable PPE items such as face masks and also single-use plastic items increased and discarded in the environment, especially during COVID-19 pandemic. And these items will eventually degrade into smaller pieces, which will be an example of secondary microplastics. And you can also find the details of this case study in the appendix section of our guidance document. As we mentioned, microplastics can also come in different shapes, such as beads, fragments, films, fibers. And this is another figure in the chapter one of our document that shows you different shapes of microplastics. And as we mentioned, depending on the size, shape, and color of these microplastics, some organisms may confuse them with food, and they may selectively feed on them. Again, depending on this shape and size, they can interact with the tissues differently. They can translocate to different organs, which will then affect their toxicity endpoints for the organisms and in humans that are exposed to microplastics. And there are some studies showing that for the microplastics that are made up from same polymeric material and same size, the rougher shapes, such as fragments, have higher chemical absorption capacity compared to the regular shapes, such as beads, because regular shapes, the rougher shapes, they will have higher surface area to volume ratio, which then enhance their capacity to attract more harmful chemical contaminants. And microplastics can absorb these harmful chemicals, such as heavy metals and persistent organic pollutants, also known as PUPs. And some examples include PCBs, PFASs, pesticides, such as DDT. And there are several factors that can enhance the chemical absorption capacity of microplastics. Microplastics are hydrophobic, meaning that they don't like water, they repel water, and therefore they can attract the chemical contaminants onto themselves from water bodies, and they can carry them in the environment as they move in the environment. And we also mentioned that microplastics have a small size. Therefore, they have a higher surface area to volume ratio, which means they can attract more chemical contaminants. Rougher shapes and weathered and aged microplastics will have higher surface area to volume ratio, which will then enhance their capacity to absorb chemicals. Polymer type is another factor that can affect the chemical absorption capacity of microplastics. Low density and rubbery plastics, such as polyethylene, or polypropylene will have a higher chemical absorption capacity than rubbery or glossy plastics, such as PET or PVC. Microplastics can also act as vectors. They can allow formation of biofilms on themselves, which then they can become vectors for carrying bacterial pathogens. They can also spread antibiotic resistant bacteria. As we mentioned, they can move long distances. They can carry those chemical contaminants along with them. Therefore, they can be sources of contaminants in aquatic environments, sediments, and biota. However, there are some data gaps regarding the vector effects of microplastics. Therefore, there are more studies needed to understand the vector effects of microplastics. And to summarize, the state of science is evolving for microplastics. And there's a notice that there's an increase in the number of microplastics toxicity studies, both in ecological and human health, especially in the recent years starting after 2015. And microplastics are emergent contaminants of concern. They do contribute to the plastic pollution. Because of their small size, they can be consumed by humans and organisms and can cause adverse health impacts to the humans and organisms that are exposed to them. And because they have a variety of physical chemical properties, they're very complex in terms of study design and also makes it challenging to compare the data in literature between the studies to evaluate the toxicity endpoints. And with that, that summarizes our introduction section of our training. And now I'm going to turn it over to Alex McDonald, who is the former employee of California Regional Water Board. And then Alex is going to introduce the interactive case study that will be used throughout this training. Thank you, Alex.
Thanks, Gisley. I work for the California Regional Water Quality Control Board. In the Central Valley. So let's get moving here. I'm going to be introducing the case study. We're going to be having this three different times within our in our presentation here. The goal of this is to keep you on your toes, to make sure you've been listening to what we've been saying, and to help reinforce the information we've been providing you. So we're starting off with a hypothetical environment. You see that the picture on the right is a bay. Think of San Francisco Bay, Tacoma, Washington area, someplace on back in the East Coast like Chesapeake Bay. So it's typical of that, you know, man's activities all around it. You have farming, industrial activities, residential areas, roadways, sewage treatment plant. Then you see there's actually a beach scene, which is kind of representing man's activities outdoors, potentially causing a problem. So what we're going to do is in our three different segments, we're going to identify sources, pathways and media, and then receptors. So we're going to develop recommendations, investigation, and evaluation at the end of all of this. So let me get started here. So the first thing we're going to do is going to identify the microplastic sources that you see on the screen here. So if you listen to what Diesel is saying and using information, because she didn't provide all those different sources, but if you happen to know of some that are on the screen, please mention those. So you're going to use the chat function, and you're going to have 30 seconds to do this. And so we're going to begin right now. So use the chat function, put the answers in the chat function. Roadways, good. Tires, very good. Tires and road plastic covers used on farms, litter, fishing gear, factory, shipping, looks like you're getting them all. Farms, everything, very good. Tires, industry, runoff. You got 5 more seconds here. Waste, rain, household, gym. All right, very good. You can stop. Very good job. I think you got everything. One of the trickier ones sometimes is if you look on this facility, there's actually the roadways and tires, but there's also paint. Paint on the roadways happen to happen to have different materials. So let's see what we got here. We have the roadway itself with the paint and the tires, wastewater treatment plant, biosolids from the wastewater treatment plant being applied to cropland, housing and all the different plastics we use in our housing material, 35% of plastic and paint sometimes, a factory, fishing boat itself. Basically, these nets are mostly made of plastic nowadays. And as they get used, they get, abrasion will knock that plastic off into the ocean. Car tires and beach use. Beach use is, dropping plastics onto the ground and having them run off and biodegrade over time. So you guys did a great job. And with that, let's see, go to my next slide here. I'm going to turn it over to Todd Mahan, Judd Mahan from Tetra Tech. And he's going to be looking at environmental distribution, fate, and transport.
Thanks, Alex. Yeah, we're going to talk about environmental distribution and fate and transport of microplastics now. Let me see if I have control of the slides to advance. And okay, here we go. So this is the conceptual site model for microplastics that's used in the online guidance document. It's an interactive figure on the online page it provides various sources, information about sources and mechanisms of microplastic transport. In this set of slides, we'll use the CSM as we talk through some examples. You can also use the interactive CSM to navigate through the online guidance document. Okay, so point sources. Here we have examples of point sources of microplastics. Point sources are discrete conveyances, such as stormwater or wastewater outfalls, smokestacks. Also, there can be marine point sources, such as ocean-going vessels that have materials lost overboard or simply discarded. Now, non-point sources, due to the ubiquitous nature of microplastics, are especially problematic. This is where there are broad areas or many sources at once that distribute microplastics into the environment. Beaches are an example where litter may be spread along a beach and then washes or is transported by wind into other areas. residential neighborhoods can be non-point sources as household products are used and discarded. Agricultural lands, another example, non-point sources. Microplastics may originate from fertilizer pellets, wastewater treatment plant biosolids that are used as soil amendments, or even home gardening materials such as plastic sheeting, containers, gloves. Roadways, also non-point sources where tires are worn down to generate tire wear particles. So this is a case study that's used in the online guidance document. Tire wear particles are generated from the friction between tires and road surfaces. The particles are then deposited in nearby surface waters or soil. 6-PPD is an anti-ozonant. It's used in tires and protects them during use in the environment. 6-PPD quinone is a byproduct, a degradation byproduct of 6-PPD that has been linked to coho salmon mortalities. Research is ongoing to help understand why coho salmon are so susceptible to the effects of 6-PPD, as well as to understand whether other aquatic organisms might be affected. There's a lot more information on this case study in the guidance document. So how are microplastics generated? There's a lot of processes involved here, both abiotic, biotic, including chemical, physical, and biological reactions. Size distribution is an important factor with fate and transport, with processes such as biofouling, aggregation, time of residence. All of this can affect the fate and transport and hence the overall distribution of microplastics. Photodegradation is important as an initial process at the Earth's surface, but biodegradation becomes important, such as in no-light zones in soils. So the fluvial environment, streams and rivers really play an important role with microplastics distribution. Physical properties determine how plastics are transported, whether that's more quickly, more slowly. Heavier particles are going to be deposited in sinks, such as lakes and other areas of decreased flow velocity. Two-way transport is a significant factor to keep in mind. Microplastics can move from land to air and potentially cycle back through these media. So surface water, freshwater systems receive microplastics from a variety of sources, including atmospheric deposition, groundwater infiltration, stormwater discharges, wastewater discharges, rivers, again, important transport corridors, and move microplastics from upland areas to bays and estuaries, which are home to many organisms that are food sources, mussels, crustaceans, other deposit feeders that can ingest microplastics. One concern that arises here is that microplastics can alter nutrient cycling and might contribute to an increase in ammonium, which could trigger red tides. Wastewater treatment plants, industrial and municipal, are one of the primary sources contributing microplastics to surface water. So with wastewater, microplastics are sourced from both industrial and domestic products. Products vary greatly, and microplastics are generated both during the manufacture and during the use of products. Treatment plants, the processes, they can successfully remove microplastics. However, there's a lack of standard treatments or analysis methods, and this limits the efficiency of microplastics removal. Many treatment plants process biosolids for land application, which can lead to re-release of plastics to the environment. Studies show that microplastics sourced from wastewater treatment plants often occur as fibers and tend to be of a relatively smaller size range, generally less than half of a millimeter. So groundwater, this is a surprise for some folks, and there's limited data availability right now, but what we do have does show that microplastics occur in groundwater, although at a lower prevalence than in other types of water. Most environmental monitoring wells are constructed of plastic, which creates an obstacle to sampling and analysis. Again, movement is affected by particle size and density, but other factors are important too, such as pH, salinity. As with so many environmental contaminants, preferential pathways aid transport. Some studies have shown that microplastics occurring in groundwater includes locations such as Illinois in the United States, as well as Germany, South Africa. As research continues, the geographic locations reporting microplastics are likely to increase. So to the oceans, plastic pollution in the oceans really has gotten a lot of attention in the public media, and there's a lot of information available. This slide touches on some of the concepts that are involved. Microplastics are entering the oceans through multiple routes, rivers, outfalls, as well as the atmosphere. They tend to move at the ocean surface towards slower moving oceanic gyres. Just denser plastics are going to sink, and they're reported from all depths. Floating debris is moved by various mechanisms. Some of these are ocean currents, as well as Stokes drift, which has to do with transport by wave action. And Langmuir circulation, which has to do with wind interacting with the ocean surface. As we mentioned, with fluvial environments, vertical transport factors include degradation, aggregation, biofouling, as well as the varying buoyancy of plastic materials. And to soil now, soils are likely to be long-term sinks for microplastics, since most plastics are used on land. Higher abundances are observed near roads and just areas where a lot of plastic is used or processed. This can include waste management facilities, agricultural areas, home gardens. Plastics have potential to alter soil properties, such as by changing the bulk density or the water retention capacity. Research is showing that plastic fibers have distinctly negative effects compared to other forms of plastic. And to sediment, as microplastics settle from the water column, they combine with sediments. This happens in marine and freshwater, flowing and non-flowing water. As we've touched on, denser plastics tend to sink and be deposited. Research indicates that sediments that are higher in total organic carbon also tend to contain more microplastics. Residence time in sediments can be high, especially in low flow conditions. And again, the resuspension and the redistribution are factors to be aware of. And the atmosphere, air, the atmospheric occurrence of microplastics, like groundwater, could surprise some folks. It's more common in urban and industrialized areas. Deposition can then occur with precipitation events. It turns out that microplastics are an emerging component of air pollution, and plastics can combine with other air pollutants. Transport varies with atmospheric factors, such as wind speed, up or down drafts. And no surprise, atmospheric occurrence, it tends to also be those smaller plastic sizes, but includes a variety of shapes and morphologies. So urban litter, so larger plastic is breaking down into microplastics. It turns out that the plastic portion of litter can vary dramatically. A study in the San Francisco Bay Area showed that 2 to 15% of litter by volume was plastic, whereas a study from the Mississippi River Basin indicated plastic making up to 74% of litter. Storm events play a big role in the transport of litter. A study in Los Angeles indicated that microplastics increased by 7 times at the coast near Long Beach after a storm. Similarly, a Great Lakes study showed that all forms of microplastics, from fragments to film to pellets, increased in concentrations as a result of precipitation events. And to the biosphere or biota, the occurrence of microplastics in living organisms is really getting a lot of attention. From plants to invertebrates, mammals, it spans all levels of the food web. Research is clearly showing that microplastics are being ingested. More studies are needed to determine the effects. With plants, studies show uptake by crops through roots, with transport then to shoots and fruits, such as tomatoes. Some organisms are particularly vulnerable. Filter feeders are at risk due to suspension feeding on particulate matter. And then other marine life, such as fish and macroinvertebrates, are also ingesting microplastics. Okay, so that's it for an overview of distribution and fate and transport. There's a lot more detail, as well as references available in the guidance document. And now I'm going to hand it back over to Alex and the interactive case study.
Thanks, Judd. Here we are on step number two. This is a two-parter. So if you've been listening to Judd over the last few minutes, this should be a piece of cake for you guys to answer these two questions. We're going to look at transport pathways and media, impacted media for microplastics. We're going to do media first. So what microplastic media, you don't see a media out here too much. I mean, they're not indicative of what, treatment plant or something like that. What media that you see are associated with impacts by microplastics? 30 seconds. It looks like everyone's starting already. Rain. Oh, well, I'll have to cut off 10 seconds. Everyone's going here. Biota, soil, air, clouds, fish, biota. Everything. Some of them, everything. That's always a good one. Water. Plankton uptake. Okay, think about media. What media are we looking at? Okay, that's about it. Let's see what the answers are here. Go to the next slide. Ambient air. We've got ambient air. Surface soils. Subsurface soils. Of course, you put them in a landfill, the subsurface soils are going to be impacted by leaching from that landfill. But what else can be impacted by this leaching from the, let's say, the cropland and from the landfill is groundwater. Judd said that's one media that most people don't think of is groundwater. Beach sand, well, of course, that goes without saying, beach sand. Crops and produce, as we apply these biosolids onto crops, they're going to be uptake, that soil is going to be uptake in those crops that we then consume. So basically, these are the media that are impacted by microplastics. The next one is, okay, we know we're at the sources, we have the media. How is it transported from those sources to those media we just described? So in 30 more seconds here, just to look at which ways do those microplastics move through environment to get to those media. Rain, wind, we're starting, boy, you guys are fast. Wastewater effluent, currents, stormwater runoff, water, wind, tsunamis, smoke, storms. Looks like people getting most of them. Tires, natural disasters. Okay, very good, very good. Let's see what we got here. Urban runoff. Everyone got urban runoff. So you see the little pink arrows. We have basically clouds. Microplastics in the air are being washed to the ground through rainfall. Goes into the stream. Goes from the stream into the water. Transport off the roadways by stormwater runoff. Wastewater treatment plant isn't making microplastics, but is receives from the community and dropping those into the water. Windblown waste from the landfill, windblown waste and water and basically migration to groundwater. The factories themselves are putting out into the atmosphere, but there's also probably wastewater discharges to the river also shown. Man's activities at the beach and in the residential areas showing that's going to be a problem also, contributing. If you went out to the fishing vessel again, we see that we have erosion from off those fishing nets, which are made of plastic. So yeah, you guys did a great job. Got them all and got some more that we don't even show on here. So, but you guys did a very good job. So with that, I am now going to turn it over to Aaliyah Enright, and she's going to go over a sampling analysis for you.
Thank you, Alex. All right. Make sure I have access to the slides. Okay. So here's an overview of what we'll talk about in this section. We'll cover considerations for selecting appropriate sampling and analysis methods. We'll cover two tools in the ITRC guidance document that we've developed, one for sampling and one for analysis. We'll cover standard and adopted methods, and we will discuss minimizing sample contamination. We return here back to our conceptual site model, this time with sampling and analysis in mind. If you click on the red dots, You can, as you can see here, you will get a link to the various guidance document sections for various media shown. These will link you to sections on both sample collection and preparation for that specific media, as you can see here. But before you use these tools to dive into the specific methods to investigate microplastics at your site, you want to first consider what your data quality objectives are. Some important considerations are shown here, and this is a very important step because the data you will be able to obtain from different sampling and analysis methods varies. For example, certain sampling methods are only able to obtain results down to a certain size range, and certain analytical methods may not be able to provide information on polymer types or shapes. Here we have a video showing our first tool. This is the sample collection tool associated with the guidance document. It's an online matrix tool that can be filtered, as you can see here, using two criteria, which are media and particle size range. In this example, we select wastewater and all size fractions. And when you select that, it provides you with the methods that fit these criteria. And it provides that in a table below. And you can change the parameters to get different results. And as you can see here, we get some different results then. The table also provides additional details that you can see here in the different columns. These are specific particle size range, sample type and description, equipment needed, advantages and disadvantages, relative cost, and some literature references if you want more information. So that matrix tool provided methods described in the literature. Due to the evolving nature of our understanding of microplastics, there are very few standardized methods for sampling of microplastics. However, there are a few standardized methods for water matrices, as you can see here. These include an ASTM standard for a variety of water types and a California Water Board's method specific to drinking water. Both of these methods use a similar concept of volumetric reduction, where you filter a large volume of water through a series of sieves to obtain a more representative sample than a simple grab sample. The second method listed here is slightly different from the first in that it specifies the use of an inline sieve filter in order to reduce the possibility of contamination from ambient air during sampling. Here we move to our second tool, this one for analytical methods. So to select the appropriate analytical method to characterize your microplastic samples, we have developed this table 3.1, an excerpt of which is shown here. Similar to the matrix, it provides capabilities and details for a variety of methods to help you determine which method is appropriate for your project. Similar to the sampling methods, there are a few methods from California that California has adopted specifically for drinking water sampling, sample analysis. As shown, these include FTIR and Raman. As we heard in the previous sections, plastics are used for an innumerable number of products in our modern world. Because of this, it is very important to both minimize and account for potential contamination of your samples throughout the sampling and analysis process. At a high level, to minimize contamination, you should eliminate plastic products used in these processes as much as you can and set up a clean laboratory. However, we can't expect to totally eliminate contamination, so we should collect various blanks to quantify potential contamination. This figure 3.2 from the guidance document shows some of the considerations a commercial laboratory implemented to create their microplastics analysis program. These include, as you can see here, aluminum ceiling tiles, a dedicated custom designed gowning room with airlock that has HVAC systems that are dedicated to the different rooms and are triggered during that trigger positive pressure when a technician moves between the exterior hallway, gowning room, and clean room. They have a twice daily cleaning with HEPA filtered vacuum and a rigorous water filtration system. So in summary, for sampling and analysis for microplastics, they are evolving and constantly being evaluated. There are two standard sampling methods for water, as we discussed, the ASTM and the California method. And California has adopted two analytical methods for drinking water, FTIR and Raman. Aside from these specific media and scenarios, we encourage you to use the two tools that we covered, the matrix and the table, to identify which methods are most appropriate for your project. And while you're investigating microplastics, make sure to minimize and account for contamination due to plastic's ubiquitous nature. Now we'll pause the content to take a quick question and answer break.
All right, let me just take control back of remote control here. And at this time, I'm going to look to the Q&A pod for any questions from our attendees, for our trainers today. So I will just give everybody a moment here to enter any questions in the Q&A pod, and we can read them out loud. And then again, reminding everybody, we do have another Q&A session at the end of our modules today. All right, we have a few questions coming in, trainers, so I'm going to read them out and look to the group for some help answering them. What do you collect samples in?
I can take that one. It really depends on the method and the media. Obviously, you would want to use products that are not containing plastic, so like containers without plastic lids and things like that if you can. If you can, glass bottles, metal sieves, things like that. But there are also a lot of methods that use things like netting that is made out of polymers. So it depends on kind of what your constraints are. So that's why we say the data quality objectives, determining that is a really important step before you determine your specific sampling methods and materials.
Thanks, Leah. Kind of in the same strain here, what type of material is used as a filter?
It depends. In those two methods, they're metal sieves. But like I said, you can use netting or other materials as well.
Great, thank you, Aaliyah. Next question, thoughts on best practices when the amount of water that can be concentrated is significantly below Ks of liters?
You say that again, specifically below what of liters?
Ks.
Just the letter K?
Thousands of liters, I would assume.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. And sorry, what was the whole question again?
Thoughts on best practices when the amount of water that can be concentrated is significantly below thousands of liters.
I mean, you can just do the best you can with the volume of water that you have. You can, you know, filter if you don't have thousands of liters to sample, then it's just a consideration, you know, it probably will have higher detection limits, but yeah.
And I'll jump in too and just say there's a lot of details on the sampling and analysis in the section, and it is so unique depending on what your media is that you're sampling and what question it is that you're asking. So we really, I think I would like to recommend that we step away from asking any more real specific sampling questions and really recommend that you go and check out our guidance document for those answers.
All right. Thank you, Aaliyah and Val. All right. Next slide. Or excuse me. Next question. In the previous slide, there were explanations about the type of microplastics, such as fragments, strings, and so on. Is the method for determining the concentration or availability of microplastics the same for all types, or is it different? We'll be happy to go back a slide.
I think the answer is it can be different, and it really is dependent on what the different types. Some of the methods are good at looking at the different features, if you will, or the types of microplastics, whether something it's a fiber or something spherical. Some are very good at being able to visualize that. So you really do need to know what your mix of microplastics is, which is not always easy environmentally, right? Because as we've seen, everything mixes together. And so I'll say, I don't think that any of us are experts in microplastic sampling and analysis, but we've got some really great data and some really great recommendations in our guidance document with links to lots of different publications. And so in terms of those details, I would just really recommend that you go in and dig into that, unless anyone else on the panel wants to jump in and answer that better.
All right, thank you, Val. Next question. What is the best way to collect data of microplastics regarding the numerical simulation of microplastics? Are there any software programs that do that?
Can you repeat that question, Devin, please?
Yeah. What is the best way to collect data for microplastics? Regarding the numerical simulation of microplastics, are there any software programs that do it? It's a two-part question.
Yeah, I will admit that I'm a little confused by the question. I think that in terms of best methods, again, like as we've said, there's so many different methods and depends on your media and what your answers are. There are different softwares out there. I would really recommend people check out Tomex in terms of that's really good at taking data that has different types of units and aligning them. It works on aligning data so that you can compare across studies. But in terms of the best or software analysis, the other reference I would say is to check out Plastiverse. I can put the link. Well, I don't know if I can, but I'll give it to Devin, and Devin can put the link in the chat for you. But Plastiverse is a really great website that has all kinds of tools available for looking at microplastics, and they're all open access. And so it's a really great resource for finding some different tools that somebody probably has come up with, and we just want to make sure that we get shared with others. Scott Coffin and a group of his colleagues run that. So I will put that, make sure we get that link in the chat for you all.
Thanks, Val. All right. So at this time, we're going to turn back over to the presentation, and then we will continue with question and answer at the end of the training. So feel free to keep putting your questions in the Q&A pod, and we will get to them at the end. And so with that, I'm going to hand it back to Valerie for the Human Health and Ecological Effects section of the webinar.
Thanks, Devin. So before we advance to the training, I would love everyone to once again use that chat function and to type in one health effect that you think, whether human health or ecological, that you think microplastics or you know microplastics might actually exposure might cause. Give people a little bit of time. All right, great. So there's lots of good answers that are coming up. Lots of fish kills, displaced food. This is really important. We'll learn more about that as we move into eco. I don't think that there's really any association with cancer at this time. That doesn't mean that it might not have a role to play, of course. But we're going to go into some more details here. But thanks everyone for the questions that you provided. So first I'm gonna give a quick overview of this section. So we're gonna talk about human health, real focus on exposures, and then we'll talk about some of the effects and some of the uncertainties in those effects that come with human health. We have a lot more information about ecological receptors. So again, we'll talk about the effects there, what toxicity tools we have available to us, and how some of this data has been interpreted and used in real life situations. So this slide is to demonstrate, once again, you already saw a slide similar to this from Dietschley about the real increase we've seen in the number of microplastic toxicity studies over the years. Of course, this ends at 2021. If we took this out to current day, we would see that number increase even more. So this is showing yellow in vivo and orange is in vitro. And, you know, we've known that there's a huge increase. I mentioned that Tomex app earlier. It takes all these toxicity studies and can input data into this application, and then you can explore the different toxicological endpoints. I know they just revised that earlier this year and added, I think, 200 more publications. So there's just a lot of work that's being done. And so this is a really rapidly evolving field. And that's just really important when we talk about these different toxicity endpoints, because there is still just so much to be learned. So in terms of human health exposures, there are multiple media and pathways for human exposures to microplastics. I mean, we've seen through the case study that Alex has presented that microplastics are ubiquitous and they're in really all media types. And so humans absolutely inhale microplastics. We have ingestion through ingestion of food crops or other foods that have been contaminated with microplastics. Say you've microwaved your food in a plastic dish that releases microplastics into your food. Of course, microplastics in the aquatic environment can be ingested by aquatic organisms that can lead to food dilution. It can also lead to trophic transfer as larger animals consume those smaller animals. Then, of course, as humans consume fish that have microplastics in them, the amount of plastics that are ingested really, our exposure, I should say, in general, really varies by region and population and lifestyle. Additionally, you know, like if you microwave a lot of stuff in plastic, then you're likely to have more microplastic ingestion. If you live in a big city, then you're more likely to have more inhalation than if you live in a rural area from that atmospheric deposition of microplastics. So far, the current estimates are that most of our human exposures come through inhalation, followed by that dietary ingestion, and then incidental ingestion, that would be through like the soil pathway. And then finally, dermal has the least exposure that we see in humans. So there are a number of challenges in evaluating the different research that's out there for toxicity in humans. While there have been many non-human mammalian studies, the usability really varies. This is uncertainties due to study design, exposure concentration, data quality, reporting, you know, like the questions about what's the appropriate method to use, how do you report the concentrations? All of those questions are really critical. And when you have a wide range of different types of what is published in the literature, it makes it very difficult to compare across different studies. And it is also really important to note that just because you're exposed to microplastics doesn't necessarily mean it's an adverse health effect. And that's always really important when we think about exposure. Okay, so in 2020 and 2021, there was a large expert group that was held virtually. And their purpose of this group was to identify, to really comprehensively evaluate a number of different non-human mammalian studies, and to look at those studies and determine, you know, what was the most highest quality data, what was needed to be able to make decisions about what were potential health impacts, and when we're looking at trying to do something like set a tox criteria or set a screening level. So this is a list of the 26 criteria that the expert panel decided were quite important, with the red being, this is the minimum that's required, and then the green being desired. And you can see that the number of studies passing is down here on the bottom. So while most studies did in fact talk about their test vehicle and their test species, and the polymer type and the particle source, and frequency of duration of endpoints, we had fewer when it got down to, you know, what is the concentration range? What is the test particle relevance, the internal dose confirmation, all of these surface chemistry, all of these things, as we've heard throughout these various parts of this training, really impact movement of microplastics, and then how much we have exposure of microplastics. And so we can see that we have, you know, very few, only 3% of the studies that were evaluated had any information about microbial contamination, for example. So through all of this limited and uncertain data, the expert panel identified what were the most reliable human toxicity endpoints that they could determine from the literature. And as you can see, most of these are around male reproduction, with sperm deformity and sperm count being high up. Now, again, remember, if you look down here on this x-axis, we're looking at numbers of studies reporting the effect. So even this highly reliable sperm deformity had only been shown in four studies. Now, this was back in 2021. I'm not certain if this has been shown in more studies since then, but this is what the expert panel decided was the most reliable of those endpoints. So male reproductive, body weight, and then also a couple of different endpoints related to liver. All right. So now what about eco? I saw a question in the Q&A pod about ecological endpoints. So this is looking at microplastic studies by different ecological group. So on the y-axis is the number of studies. Yellow indicates that there was an effect seen. Orange indicates that the effect was not seen. As expected, we have more studies in fish than we do in some of the other types of ecological groups. And this data here is based off of a number of studies that were in that TOMEX, that Toxicity of Microplastics Explorer that I mentioned earlier. And that's how this figure was generated. So, okay, let's look a little bit at these factors affecting aquatic toxicity, since we have so much research available for us there. So this figure is adapted from a Mahinto et al. Paper. And they really identified that there were two different types of toxic endpoints that we saw in aquatic animals, and that it really depended on particle size. So those smaller particle sizes, that probably in those nanometer type ranges, I think it was actually less than 84 nanometers. I'm sorry, I should have looked that up. I should recall what that is, and I can put it in the chat later. But the smaller numbers, those resulted in cellular damage. There was actually translocations. They cross the cell membrane. They create reactive oxygen generation, neurological endpoints, and those are surface area dependent. As the particle size gets larger, we're looking more at that physical damage side of things. We're looking at food dilution. So that's animals, you know, thinking that they're getting as much food as they need, but really they're just eating plastics. So then they might starve because they have nutritional defects. Gastrointestinal obstruction, so that's, you know, consuming too much and then it gets blocked, and then, you know, they will not survive that. And then, of course, we have irritation and injury, and that's more volume dependent. So the more larger particle sizes that were ingested, the more you would see this physical damage. So the here we go. So it was less than the 83 micrometers have the ability to translocate, and that's what causes the cellular damage. And we saw that fibers were the most commonly found microplastic, but those are still really misunderstudied in terms of tissue translocation, which makes sense. Something that's thin and long would have a harder time crossing over the membrane than something that is, you know, smaller and easier to translocate. In terms of the nutritional deficiencies, again, microplastics often mistaken for food would cause nutritional deficiencies due to food dilution. And there is also a preferential consumption of particles by size, shape, and color, as Dietschley mentioned earlier in the introduction. So again, TOMEX, I mention it once again. This is this great application where they can input a whole bunch of different data and then evaluate it. So using TOMEX and looking at all of the different aquatic endpoints that were put into that, this is multiple different publications, the data is put in, and then they were able to analyze it. They determined five different thresholds of concern for aquatic environments. So this goes from no concern, low concern, moderate, up to the highest concern, where we really think that pollution controls are needed. And so on the left is showing what these different thresholds are. And on the right, apologize, it looks like the quality of the image has faded a little bit. But on the right, this shows how these thresholds were applied to monitoring data that was collected in the San Francisco Bay here in California. And the main takeaway here is that we're really seeing all of these different thresholds are met within the San Francisco Bay. We have some of the highest concern interior here. And then the further you get out, you get to the lower concern, which is probably, as we would suspect, as you get further away from human activities. But this was a really nice case study where they took that Tomex app, looked at all of these different aquatic studies that had been done, developed thresholds, and then applied it to real life data that can then help the state of California make some decisions about monitoring as we move forward. Again, I would like to point out this case study. This is the appendix A2, which is the consequences of microplastics on the various ecological endpoints in the Chesapeake Bay, with a focus on the blue crab and the trout here. And so we recommend that you go and read that case study and find out some more information. So overall, the health effects summary, there are physical, chemical, and biological hazards associated with microplastics. Exposure characterization is highly uncertain. We need more adverse health outcome pathways need to be explored, but we do know that particle size and shape do strongly influence toxicity. But ultimately, the big takeaway is we still have a lot more to learn before we can set things like toxicity criteria, particularly in humans. And with that, I'm going to hand it back over to Alex for our case study.
Thank you, Valerie. So you should be looking at our last slide, at last group of slides here on the case study. This is the last quiz that you're going to have. So we're now looking at, we looked at sources of microplastics. We looked at what media are being exposed to those microplastics. We looked at routes of a migration from the sources to those media. And now we're going to look at, okay, who's being impacted? Who are the receptors that you see in this picture over here? So we're going to start back to the chat again. You have 30 seconds to look at and give me answers for what are the receptors that you see in this picture. Animals, fish, human, mammals, birds, mammals, fish and birds, humans, food crops, livestock, birds. We seem to be getting rabbit, marine dolphin, any living organism, of course. That's a good one. Eco, marine and terrestrial, and human. Very good. Mollusks, dogs and rabbits, marine habitat. Okay, you can stop answering here and we'll see what answers we actually came up with here. Okay. So human, if you look at, we have two columns here. Possible human ones are the beach user and the bay swimmer. You know, look at the person swimming out in the bay. Agricultural workers, you know, the ones at the farm where the biosol is being applied. Factory workers where inside you're getting exposed to the plastics that are manufactured or used in manufacturing. Urban residences, you know, all the different microplastics, consumer products that they're exposed to. Local anglers, sure, people that the people are going to eat the fish that are being harvested out of the marine life there. And then yes, we have produce and crop consumers. So yeah, you got a great job on that. And then of course all the ones on the other side, cattle and herbivores, aquatic mammals, vegetation. The one we didn't kind of get, which is kind of a tricky one, soil invertebrates. That's a one that you really wouldn't see. You don't see them on this picture, but you figure if they migrate into the soil, the soil invertebrates that are in the soil column are going to be exposed. So we take all that information. Okay, we want to answer questions about, you know, who's being exposed, where is it coming from, how's it being transported, where are the sources. We need to decide, obviously, just like any contamination site or anytime you're doing an investigation area, you have a conceptual site model development standard, as if you're looking at a metal in soil or PCBs or the solvent in the air. So then you have to develop a sampling analysis plan based on the questions you're going to answer. You're trying to ask what kind of questions do you want answered here? Are we looking at effects on aquatic life in the bay? Are we looking at cropland and migration through the soil column in various areas? Crop uptake. So all depending on those questions, just like you do with any pollutant, you're going to do that. Plastics is no different. But what you notice with plastics, we have a whole range of different receptors, whole range of how the stuff moves to the environment. It's everywhere. It's not just very specific to one location. So it does make the complexities pretty high. So with that, I'm going to turn it over back over to myself, and we're going to discuss regulatory context. So I don't have to, no one has to switch over here, and we're going to go to the first slide. Well, back in 2021, ITRC sent out a survey to all the 50 states, and we got responses back from 25 of those states. And this slide's going to kind of discuss a couple of the main key points that we got back from those responses we received. And if you look over there on the right-hand side, you see in box A, we had one of the questions we asked is, are you sampling for microplastics? And we had three states, California, Texas, and New Jersey, who stated that they have sampled for microplastics. They themselves, it doesn't mean that some of these other states might have had other entities sample for microplastics for them, or maybe in a wastewater discharge or something of that nature, but only three states, they actually did their own sampling for microplastics. And if you look in the bottom box, we asked the question, are you going to be establishing regulatory criteria for microplastics? No states currently had any regulatory criteria, and only two states, California and Pennsylvania, are looking at establishing criteria, and a further six states said they may establish regulatory criteria. So microplastic criteria is a slow moving process. I mean, as Valerie is saying, we don't know for sure that there's a health impact associated with this. There's a lot of uncertainty in that, and it's hard to get the legislatures to react to with all that uncertainty existing. So here's some examples. If you look at when we went through the state survey, but we also went to all 50 states' websites and tried to come up with what kind of legislation and laws are being proposed for tackling microplastics. In fact, we saw very little, if any, cases where legislatures are doing something about microplastics. They're focusing mostly on plastics in general. And in doing so, it's not like they're forgetting microplastics. If you recall, a lot of microplastics are formed by the breakdown of macroplastics or larger pieces of plastic. So them taking action on those larger pieces of plastic is a good thing if we can keep that out of the environment. So those common efforts as legislatures are applying are recycling mandates, requiring recycling of certain materials, phase out of single-use plastics. You go to the grocery store, they give you a plastic bag to put your whatever you purchased in. And then going to the restaurant industry, when you have takeout food, the food packaging that comes in and the utensils they supply to make those, get rid of those as being plastic, make them out of recyclable materials, at least. And it's of interesting note, there are actually some states that have actually banned implementations of these types of restrictions on the local level. So the states don't want the locals making up their own rules that are restricting the use of plastics. One of the things that you don't see on the slide, which actually there is another item that is actually getting more at play now, is actually focusing on consumer products such as facial scrubs, toothpaste, carpets, that sort of thing, and getting microplastics and plastics out of those types of consumer products. So what our team did was they put together Appendix C, which is basically a set of tables listing the regulations that are out there. So what we did was if you look at the bottom of the slide, there's five tabs on our table, and each one of those tabs on the right-hand side would list the different programs that each one of the states have, or if a state had no programs, it would state that. So this was done in 2021, 22. So if there's new ones since then, those aren't included in our tables. But the state programs, you're looking at what they do for microplastics and macroplastics, and focusing mostly on macroplastics. There are a few states that have some microplastic legislation going on. The federal programs, such as the Clean Water Act, the Marine Debris Act, and so forth are found in, under the federal programs. In addition, the any legislation coming out of Congress, such as the has to do with I'll skip that one. But then in international, we have an international tab which focuses on some of the international community is actually ahead of the United States in certain microplastic legislation or legislation in their regard. So if you take a look at this, here's an example of what's in our table. So if you look at Connecticut, line 20 there, you can see Connecticut has had a House Bill number 5,360. And what they were what it does is it establishes a working group of representatives from both the retail and apparel industry and the environmental community to focus on synthetic microfiber pollution. And this working group is trying to develop consumer awareness and education programs on in order to present information regarding synthetic microfibers in clothing. As I said, they're trying to, you know, take things out of the consumer products. And this is these guys are working collaboratively to try to educate the public on, hey, polyester is not so great. And then we provide, if you look on the far right, we provide whatever possible a link that will provide additional information if that's what you're interested in, and go back to that source and get those answers. So the international, we click on the international tab, and you'll see a whole list of different things that different countries are doing in the European Union. And those those are listed here in the same manner we did for the states. And we provide web links to those different environmental laws and regulations and so forth that have been produced by those countries. So let's take a look at the European Union. Basically, here how it's taken and steps it's taken to restrict microplastics. Here's one example. In 2019, the European Chemical Agency proposed a restriction on intentionally added microplastics to consumer and professional products. So from there, in 2020, that agency's Committee for Risk Assessment reported that the proposal accepted that proposal and recommended removing a lower limit on the size of microplastics added to products. Then earlier in this year, in April of this year, the registration, evaluation, authorization, and restriction of chemical committee, nice, that shows you that the United States isn't the only one that has long government entities that have many names to them. And of course, they use an acronym called REACH. They accepted that proposal. And then in September of this year at the European Parliament, in September, the measures were adopted to restrict intentionally added microplastics. So they're taking steps ahead of most of the United States in restricting those in consumer products. Go back one slide, one too many. The UN has actually stepped up into the fray here, and they had 175 members nations agreed to develop by the end of 2024 an internationally legally binding instrument to address plastic pollution. This UN resolution to end plastic pollution was signed in March 2022, and included microplastics in the definition of plastics. This slide has an excerpt from the resolution, and I'll let me read it to you because it's kind of common. It's good mom apple pie things that should be done. Microplastics, mostly from tires, pellets, textiles, and personal care products, can be addressed by reducing automotive mileage, like the tires, redesigning tires and behavioral change, improved design and production of garments, introducing filters on washing machines, improved production and value change of plastic pellets, and facilitating their safe transport and banning the use of intentionally added microplastics to personal care products. So I think the United States can take a look at this, and I think that it's something that we can copy, and hopefully we can move through the federal government. And if not, you know, states might have to step up to the plate. Okay, my last slide here. We have a case study within our document. It's talking about California and what their approach to taking care of microplastics. So if you look at California, basically in 2018 adopted two Senate bills, or issued two Senate bills, 1422 and 1263, that deal with microplastics. 1422 is focused on drinking water, included the definition of microplastics in it, and required that the state adopt a standard method for testing of microplastics in drinking water. It also included a four-year drinking water testing and reporting requirement. Obviously, all the water utilities and water providers had to be a part of this program. And then it also required that all that information they collected had to be made available to the public. So in 2022, a policy handbook was issued to help implement that four-year testing effort. And with the first 2 years of monitoring being completed, they would have a six-month evaluation, including to figuring out if more sophisticated test methods were needed. And then following with that, Senate Bill 2063, it committed the state to developing and implementing a statewide microplastic strategy. This strategy was issued in February of 2022 and provides a multi-year roadmap identifying specific actions the state plans to take. So California is a little bit ahead of the game than most of the other states around in regards to microplastics here. They might be a little bit behind on things like PFAS, but in microplastics, they're trying to set the pace. So with that, I will turn it over to Yasmin Kanuku of Rue, and she will be looking at mitigation and abatement of microplastics.
Thank you, Alex, for overview of the current state regulations regarding microplastic and macroplastics. I will now be covering mitigation and abatement section, which can be found in section 6 of our online document. During the first half of my presentation, we will focus on prevention and mitigation strategies and best management practices to reduce microplastics from entering the environment. The second half, we will focus on technologies to abate, treat, and remediate microplastics once it exists in the environment, whether in drinking water, surface water, marine water, groundwater, wastewater, soil, sediment, and air. In order to keep as much material out of the landfill as possible, it is important for each of us to do our part. One of the ways to put this plan into action is to apply a waste management hierarchy as guidance for managing plastics. The United States Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, created a waste management hierarchy that categorizes the steps necessary to manage in a method that benefits people and reduces impact on the environment. As you can see on this figure, the most preferred method of waste management is source reduction and reuse. This is preventing microplastics from entering the environment. It is necessary. That is followed by recycling, composting, and energy recovery. And the least preferred method you can see at the bottom is treatment and disposal. However, more studies are needed to achieve the necessary removal of microplastics in different media. Go back. What is going on? How can I go back? Okay, I think it should be okay. Sorry, let's do that over here. Okay. Let's focus on the mitigation and prevention strategies. This is located in our online guidance documents under the section 6 and section 611, manufacturing and packaging, just mostly focusing on the reducing plastic packaging and increasing plastic reuse. The second section is improving production efficiency under section 612, including life cycle assessment, LCA, and alternative analysis of plastic product and material substitutions to prevent regrettable solutions. Let's talk about the LCA life cycle assessment. What does it mean? LCA is a tool used to assess the environmental impact of a product or process from beginning to end, to identify strategic improvement opportunities such as sustainable solutions, to avoid regrettable substitutions, social and supply chain impacts. The use of plastics can be reduced by using alternative, recycled, or non-plastic biodegradable materials, improving the design to reduce the amount of plastic used, extend product life, allow repair and reuse, and improve recyclability by limiting the number of polymers, additives, and mixtures. And the last one is banning certain types of single-use plastics. As you can see on this figure, there are some LCA stages from the distributed recycling via additive manufacturing, also known as 3D printing, related to the use of recycled materials by means of mechanical recycling process in the printing process chain. Considering the different stages of additive manufacturing processes, a broad field of opportunities emerges to develop more sustainable means of production at different levels of chain values. This shift goes from design and manufacturing optimization until the synthesis of advanced materials into the final product. Mitigation and prevention strategies, what are they? The issues related to microplastic contamination can only be controlled by incorporating responsible and sustainable practices into the production, use, and waste disposition of different plastic materials. Significant reduction in plastic consumption and waste generation can be achieved through product substitution and education. As shown on this figure, the details of reducing the plastic consumption can be found in section 613 of the online guidance document. Let's talk about the following section, which is section 614, improving disposal of waste. Significant improvements to waste disposal can only be achieved through global initiatives that involve education and buy-in on waste minimization practices, expanded collection services for reuse, recycling, and disposal, reduced production of non-reusable and non-recyclable materials, and further improvements to recycling processes. North American and European countries typically have organized public or private waste collection services, but a large part of the world's population, unfortunately, doesn't have access to an organized collection of waste for disposal at properly designed landfills. and even less for recycling, for which options are often not affordable or not available. There are several options for managing plastic waste, as you can see on the screen as well. For example, source collection and post-separation disposal, reuse or regrouping, waste to energy and feedstock, landfilling, bio-based and biodegradable plastic alternatives, electronic waste recycling and enhancing distribution, storage transportation, and the last one is storm water control. Related to bio-based and biodegradable plastics, I would like to point that being bio-based does not make it any more biodegradable or any less likely to create microplastics. These products are recyclable through the normal recycling pathways. So let's wrap up the first part of my presentation regarding prevention and mitigation. Before we move into discussing remediation technologies, I would like to everyone to use the chat function to comment one thing that can be done to reduce microplastics from entering in the environment. Let's give everyone a couple of seconds to answer. Yeah, I can see all different kind of practices that we can implement. They are all good. I can see that prevention, buy less, increased coverage of collection. These are all great. And just I wanna give this case study as an example. In addition to lots of good ideas that provided in the chat, this is the one of the case studies that also you can find in appendix A6 of the guidance document, online guidance document. This is shows the one of the case studies that where the installation of washing machine filters shown to significantly reduce the number of microfibers entering the wastewater treatment plants in a community in Ontario, Canada. I will not give you the details of this case study. You can review it when you have time later. So now we will be moving on the abatement portion of my presentation. The treatment technologies described in section 621 through section 624 are organized by media based on the degree of development and implementation, as well as confidence in the technology based on peer-reviewed literature and the professional judgment of the authors. Two levels of implementation confidence are defined in the guidance document. The first one is field implemented technologies that have been demonstrated under full-scale conditions at multiple sites by multiple practitioners and multiple applications and are well documented in practice or peer-reviewed literature. Wastewater treatment plants and drinking water treatment plants are some of examples for the field implemented technologies. The second one is the developing technologies, technologies that have been researched at the laboratory or bench scale, but have not been field demonstrated. Often these results are reported by only one group, for example, one university practitioner or vendor, or lack detailed validation of the treatment effectiveness or mechanisms. For example, acoustic focusing, electrochemical oxidation, magnetic extraction are some of examples for developing technologies. The this is figure 6.5 from the guidance document, shows a conceptual estimation of microplastic removal and retention in different stages of wastewater treatment plants. If you refresh your memory regarding the stages in the wastewater treatment plants, as you can see on this figure as well, there are preliminary, primary, secondary, and tertiary treatment. And when we look at this, each step, for example, in the preliminary and primary treatment, there is some grit chambers, grit removal, primary settling tank, secondary treatment, usually activated sludge reactors, bioreactors, membrane biofilters, and the tertiary treatment, disk filter, for example, rapid and sand filtration, ozonation, coagulation can be used. As shown on this figure, when we look at the removal efficiencies for the each individual treatment stages, we can see that this treatment range between 2 to 75% for the microplastic removal. However, when you combine these individual stages with the tertiary treatment, you can see that 94 to 99% of microplastic removal was observed based on the literature review that we performed. In the online guidance document, there are two tables, table 6.3 and table 6.4, showing the treatment technologies by media. Table 6.3 provides a summary of potential treatment technologies for removing microplastics from drinking water, surface water, groundwater, marine, and wastewater. Table 6.4 provides a summary of potential treatment technologies for soil. Unfortunately, there are no tables available for air, since there are really few studies focusing on the atmospheric microplastics. Also, I would like to note that the screenshot for the, for example, this table 6.3 and table 6.4 is just a small portion of the very large table that outlines more than, I think, 20 different treatment technologies. So I will not go over these treatment technologies today, unfortunately, because of the time limitation that we have. So I am going to give you a brief tour how we can use these tables efficiently. Every time I mention that we created this table based on the media and also, you know, the treatment category. When I click over here, you can see that this treatment categories, it is physical, chemical, and biological. And after that, you can see at the top, treatment technology, media, advantages, efficiencies, and references. When you look at the media, you can see that if it is this technology used for surface water or groundwater, wastewater, you can see that for each treatment category, for each media. Also, there is a arrows that you can see that the shows if the technology is developing technology or lab scale technology, or if it is, we said, general technology. This means that both field implemented or laboratory scale or developing technology. So it is important to note that removal efficiency percentages shown on this table, removal efficiencies are based on laboratory studies that have not fully implemented in the field. This is still much work to be done in developing remedial technologies for large-scale removal of microplastics from the environment. You can settle the same one and go back. Sorry, every time I am jumping on the okay, I think that we are just wrapping up. Let's summarize what we learned from mitigation and abatement section. I think the most important factor is source reduction. Source reduction to reduce microplastics in environment is really, really critical. In order to minimize the negative impacts derived from plastic pollution, different strategies would have to be considered simultaneously, not only reduction in the use of plastics and their replacement by other alternatives, such as cardboard or biodegradable polymers, but also eco-design, environmental education, improvement in waste management. We talk about, for example, LCA and others. Based on the literature review, including the studies that we did go over today, it is obvious that existing treatment technologies have been showing different success to reduce or remove the microplastics. It is also very important to consider management of waste produced during the treatment of microplastics. When you treat the, wastewater, you are not done yet. We know that you're going to have, biosolids and other stuff that you need to take care of. And this is the end of my presentation. Right now, I am going to turn over to the Todd Miller from Kennedy Jenks to wrap up today's training. Thank you for attending.
Thank you, Yasmin. Before we get to the Q&A section of the training, I'm going to provide a brief wrap up of what we covered today. And just a reminder for all of you on the training that all of the information we've presented here today is available in the document, and the online document contains far more information than what we've presented here today. Let's see. There we are. So what you see on the slide here is just a URL for the guidance document that can be found on the ITRC website. Let's see. In the introduction section, this is my apologies. It's so the topics covered here today. My apologies, folks. So the topics covered here today include the introduction of microplastics and why they're important. They're found ubiquitous and persistent in the environment. They contain harmful chemicals and they're consumed by animals and humans, resulting in potential health impacts and impacts to the environment. In the environmental distribution, fate, and transport section, we described primary and secondary sources, how microplastics are released into the environment, and how they're transported and where they end up, and various degradation pathways. In the sampling and analysis portion of the training, we describe the state of the science for sampling and analyzing microplastics, as well as concerns that can impact the results. During the human health and ecological effects portion, we describe the pathways for human and ecological exposure, the challenges of reviewing and comparing microplastic study results, how particle size and chemical makeup play key roles in the effects, and briefly presented tools available to evaluate health risks. In the current regulation sections, we've presented the key results, the ITRC group poll of 25 states, which showed that only 3 states have sampled for microplastics and no states had regulatory criteria, although several were considering some form of them. And again, that poll was done back in 2021, so those results have likely changed by now. And during the mitigation and abatement portion, we discussed BMPs that focused on keeping plastics out of the environment by reducing and using developing alternative products, educating the public on alternatives, and improving recycling. As a reminder, throughout the document, you'll see the CSM figure shown here on the right-hand side of your screen. In the introduction section, clicking on each of the red dots will bring you a short description of how microplastics are found in the environment. And in subsequent sections, these dots will link you to associated sections of the text. Section 7 of the document describes data gaps regarding microplastics knowledge or information. So for freight and transport, the fact that microplastics are found nearly everywhere we look, but the transport mechanisms are only partially understood, represents a major data gap. For sampling analysis, there's need for better reference standards, better analytical instruments, and lower costs. For health risks, impacts to human health and the environment are not very well understood. Additionally, how changes to the physical and chemical structures of microplastics can impact our ability to fully assess risks to microplastics. For trophic transfer, there's a large need to better understand the impacts that size and shape have on how microplastics move through the food web. And for mitigation and abatement, the need for replacement products, as well as better practices to control and remove microplastics from the environment. There are six case studies featured in Appendix A of the Microplastics Guidance Document. Case study number one is the California approach for microplastics, which describes the legislation and other activities that the state of California is taking related to microplastics. Case study two is the consequences of microplastics on various ecological endpoints in the Chesapeake Bay and its tributary estuary, the Potomac River. This case study focuses on the effects of microplastics on three organisms found in the Chesapeake Bay, the hooked mussel, the blue crab, and the striped bass. Case study three is impact of disposable PPE and single-use plastic items during COVID-19 pandemic, which explores the effects of increase in single-use plastics related to the COVID-19 pandemic. Case study four is nurdles along the Gulf Coast and describes a notable spill of plastic nurdles into the Mississippi River. Case study five was effects of 6 PPD quinone on coho and chum salmon. This case study presents the evaluation of tire wear particles' impact on acute mortality in coho salmon and details mitigation efforts to decrease the transport and tire wear particles to surface waters. And case study six is washing machine filter reduction filters reduce microfiber emissions to aquatic ecosystems, which describes a policy brief that was prepared for Toronto, Canada. We hope you can take time to review these case studies to gain more information about these various subjects. We'd like to bring everyone's attention to a new ITRC that started in February 2023, referred to as the Microplastics Outreach Toolkit. The team is utilizing the information contained in the ITRC Microplastics Guidance Document to create an outreach toolkit that contains products such as downloadable fact sheets and social media campaigns to provide clear communication to the public about the extent of the problems presented by microplastics, how people in our environment are being affected by microplastics, and what citizens can do to help reduce microplastics. It's our hope that the Microplastics Outreach Toolkit will provide valuable resources for environmental professionals to engage with and educate clients, regulators, and the public about microplastics. This slide here shows just a few of the examples of the draft fact sheets that are on the Outreach Toolkit website at the moment. And now I'd like to turn it back over to Devin from ITRC to facilitate the question and answer portion of our training.
Thanks so much, Todd, and the rest of our trainers for those great modules. We're going to jump right into our final Q&A, and then we'll wrap up the training. So I'm going to look to the Q&A pod here. And Yasmin, I see you're typing a response, but I'm going to go ahead and read that question out loud and let you take a stab at it. First question, when can we expect NPDES guidelines require for microplastics?
Yeah, I would like to add a couple of things regarding this, because when we look at it, the only active state is California regarding the microplastics, working on the microplastic. I know that New Jersey DEP is doing some studies to release the drinking water quality standards for microplastics, but these studies are not completed yet. I will say that before, I think, drinking water quality standards regulated, it's not going to come to the NPDES guidelines. So I think we still need more time for that.
All right. Thank you so much, Yasmin. Same with that question. Alex, I see you type in a response to another question in the Q&A pod, and I'm going to go ahead and read it out loud and punt it to you for an answer. Is a TMDL for microplastics for water bodies a tool being considered for regulatory action to address the problem?
Did you want me to answer that? I'm sorry.
Well, so you did type a response publicly, but maybe if you have anything you want to add to it, or I'd open it up to any other trainers.
Yeah, I have not seen any states currently using microplastic information to set TMDLs. However, California is using it to set their 303D list, which is the list of water quality segments that are impaired. And that basically sets up the process to then go to a TMDL later on.
All right. Thank you, Alex. So I will pause here. We don't have any more questions right now in the Q&A pod. I did put the link to the feedback form in the chat for all of our attendees to have some easy access. But again, it's on the Kluin training page that brought you here. So if you're looking for a certificate of completion, you're going to get one by completing the feedback form. Many of you have asked for the webinar slides. They are also posted on the microplastic Kluin training page that brought you to the training as well. So all of that information as well as trainer bios is located on that page. So with that, I would just like to say thank you to our expert trainers for being here and helping us deliver this excellent training. And beyond that, thank you for helping develop this excellent training. We could not have done it without you. I'd also like to thank our attendees for taking time out of their day to join us, and we hope to see you in a future ITRC training event. If you have any further questions or would like any further clarification on any questions answered, feel free to get in touch with us at itrc@itrcweb.org. You're also welcome to get in touch with our trainers directly. Their information is listed on the Kluin training page. So with that, I will wish everyone a wonderful rest of their day, and thank you again for joining us. Thank you, trainers, for a wonderful training session.